God is good?
All the time.
All the time?
I'm good.
Happy Thanksgiving? Speaking of Thanksgiving, I got to wondering recently about a curious English phrase, the phrase, let's talk turkey. Wherever did that come from, I wondered. Well, here's one explanation. Back when an English settler and a Wampanoag Indian went out together hunting for birds, together they caught a number of turkeys and a number of vultures. Turkeys and buzzards. When they got back, the pilgrim divided them, taking the turkeys for himself and giving to the Indian the buzzards. Annoyed, the Wampanoag responded, "Stop talking buzzards, let's talk turkey." So let's talk turkey about money. In the 1600s in Massachusetts and Boston, money was a muddle. There were lots of different kinds of money, but not enough of it. Really, really not enough of it. Much local trade was conducted by barter. A coat might be exchanged for a bearskin, a barrel of molasses for a pile of pine boards. Musket bullets were used instead of farthings. And the Indians had devised an economic system of their own, wampum. For them, clamshells were the coin of their realm. And having entered their realm, the English learned to use and trade in wampum. As to coinage, there were in circulation coins from England, Holland, Spain, Mexico, Portugal. Problematically, each country had a kind of different system and different standards of weight and fineness. And to make matters worse, lots of the coins were counterfeit, composed of as much alloy as their bootleg makers thought they could possibly get away with. So not only were the coins scarce, they were unreliable, and it was confusing. You'd pull out of your pocket all these different kinds of coinage, and there was no standard system. Money was a muddle. They needed more money. They needed some means of standardizing the coinage in circulation, and they needed to find a way to reduce the occurrence of counterfeit coins. But how? What to do? The British Crown owned the privilege of making money. Well, an opportunity arose. In 1649, King Charles I was beheaded. England was declared a commonwealth, and Oliver Cromwell stepped in as Lord Protector. This was New England's moment. Carpe diem. And so they did. In the absence of royal authority, the New England Puritans quickly asserted themselves. The General Court of Massachusetts hustled and by 1652 had authorized a mint for coining shillings, sixpences, and threepences. This would be the first mint in the colonies and, in fact, became the only mint that ever operated. They hired for this work John Hull. John Hull was, at the time, 28 years old. Who here is 28 years old? I know that Heidi is. Thank you, Heidi. Anybody else 28 years old? Donnie? So, nothing against you guys, but can you imagine handing over the entire colonial treasury to a 28-year-old? Hull had been born in England. With his Puritan parents, he came to Massachusetts when he was 11 years old. For the first 7 years after coming here, he farmed with his father. And at about age 18, he began to apprentice as a silversmith. So he had been silversmithing for a full decade, 10 years, by the time the general court turned to him, making him, at the grand age of 28, the first mint master. Now, John Hull lived on an estate with his parents just about a block from here, now the infamous site of Filene's and Macy's. It kind of covered all of that property. Having contracted with their new mint master, the General Court of Massachusetts then commissioned a building to house the mint. And this was to be conveniently located on the Hull estate. So John had no commute at all. The minting house was a simple wooden edifice, 16 feet square, 10 feet high. And in addition, the General Court supplied young Mr. Hull with the necessary equipment and tools. He was set up. And at this point, I turn the story over to Nathaniel Hawthorne. He takes it up in this way. Hereupon, all the old silver in the colony was handed over to John Hull. The battered silver cans and tankards, and silver buckles, and broken spoons, and silver buttons off of worn coats, and silver hilts of swords that had once figured at the court, and silver candlesticks, and silver jewelry. And in addition, the mint took both counterfeit and regulation weight coins, Spanish and otherwise. In other words, anything at all containing silver was accepted, handed over to young John Hull, who assayed them, threw them into the melting pot, melted them down. And from this curious assortment of silver, young John Hull struck a new local standard coinage, a coin of this realm, the pine tree shilling. On one side are stamped Massachusetts and the image of a pine tree, and on the other side, New England, the year 1652, and Roman numerals denoting the value. Roman numeral 12 denotes 12 pence or a shilling. At first, the mint operated with impunity. However, with the restoration of Charles II in 1660, the situation back in New England and at the Hull estate got dicey. Shortly after his ascendancy to the throne, Charles II notified the colonists of what they knew well already, that the production of silver coinage was a royal prerogative. The colony, demanded Charles II, was to cease and desist the minting of coins. Young John Hull found himself operating a business that was seditious and treasonous. The colonists responded to the king's cease and desist order, but perhaps not in the way you might imagine. They did not close the mint. They neither ceased nor desisted in the making of coins. Instead, they sent to His Royal Majesty, King Charles II, gifts. They bribed him. The colonists commissioned and sent to the king for his Royal Navy large masts cut from trees up in the woods of Maine, the likes of which could not be found anywhere in merry old England. In addition, they loaded the king's ships until they were heavy with codfish, barrels of cranberries, and special Indian porridge made from corn. Moreover, the pine tree shilling was minted for 30 years, starting in 1652, and for 30 years, but every coin struck by John Hull was stamped with the same year, 1652. Why? Well, the colonists were careful to maintain the illusion that all the coins that were in circulation had been struck during the confusion between Charles I and Charles II, giving the appearance that they had never and were not at present defying the royal crown. They'd simply taken advantage of a brief moment of opportunity. So the king never issued a royal minting privilege, but neither did the king do the drastic deed of closing the mint. Instead, the tall, stout masts from Maine handsomely bore the navy's sails, The cranberries, fish, and porridge were lustily consumed at the royal table. The bribes worked. But why, you ask, other than the novelty of the story, would we concern ourselves with young Mr. John Hull? What has he to do with us, you ask? Excellent question. I'm getting there. Just another minute. By agreement with the general court, young Mr. Hull, mint master, pocketed for every 20 shillings he made, 1 shilling for himself. And the mint, as it turns out, was wildly successful, beyond what the general court and young Mr. Hull had ever imagined. And young Mr. Hull became old Mr. Hull, and as he did so, he grew to become among the richest men in the colony. One of the principal merchants of his time, John Hull, came to own, on his own accord, 2 vessels, and he had an interest in another 14. His sailing vessels were constantly engaged in commercial voyages back and forth to England, France, and the West Indies. In addition, Hull owned a huge tracts of farmland outside of the city of Boston, and down in the wilds of Cape Cod, he kept a herd of wild horses. And the Hull mansion, located on the property now occupied by Filene's and Macy's, included a herbal kitchen garden, flower gardens, plots of vegetables, and orchards of pear and apple trees. There were also stables, a coach house, small abodes for the tenant farmer and some of the family servants, and not least, there was on the property the mint, the building that housed the colonial treasury. John Hull, over these years, served as selectman and treasurer of the town of Boston and as treasurer of the entire colony. He was treasurer at war during King Philip's War, which, as the colony had trouble paying for it, he actually helped finance that war out of his own pocket. It was then, as an established, very wealthy merchant, that John Hull became one of the founding members, one of the 28 founding members of this congregation. With all those shillings to back him up, when John Hull spoke, people listened. When John Hull was among the leaders, the schismatics, who defected from First Church, broke away over an argument on baptism, others followed him. John Hull was the first elected elder of this congregation in 1669, and he was one of a handful of subscribers who each gave £100 toward the building of our very first meeting house right here on this location. In addition, while doing business in England, John Hull was commissioned by the other founders to procure for them a worthy minister for the new congregation. Hull was 59 when he died. He is buried in the granary burial ground over there in the Hull Sewell tomb. He is buried between the tombs of Paul Revere and the parents to Benjamin Franklin. So John Hull is, in so many ways, for us, a grand ancestor. It is very probable that this congregation would not exist without John Hull, without his pluck, also without his wealth and his prestige. But let's talk turkey. Our colonial forebears had mixed relationships with the American Indians whose homeland they invaded. The colonial legacy is contested and complex. It is easy to view the introduction of a mint, of a coin, as plucky, ingenious, a solution to a very real, very difficult problem for the early colonists. It was plucky, ingenious, courageous. At the same time, the mint had the effect of usurping what had been the coin of this realm for the Indians, wampum. Against the local production of silver coinage, the Indians, they didn't stand a chance. So when we come into this hallowed hall, this our ancestral home. We find ourselves in the company of our forebears. All of them. The colonial mint master and his servants, the pilgrim and the Wampanoag, the victor and the vanquished. Our ancestors, like ourselves, were a muddled lot, a strange mixture of good and bad, desperation and ingenuity, pluck and pretense. And money, then and as now, is a two-sided, maybe even a two-faced thing. Money can be either buzzard or turkey. It can be either filthy or eminently agreeable. Jesus talked turkey about money. He insisted on what we so often deny, that money is an indisputable dynamic in an intimate and intricate web of relationships, not only between ourselves, but between ourselves and our God. As St. Luke tells it, Jesus perceived their craftiness and said to them, "Show me a denarius. Whose head and whose title does it bear?" And they said to him, "The emperor's." And he said to them, "Then you give to the emperor the things that are the emperor's, and to God the things that are God's." And being amazed by his answer, they became silent.